Good day, and welcome to the Inside the Beltway conference call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, Deanna, thank you very much. And hello, everybody. Good morning to everybody except those of you on the East Coast, and good afternoon to you. The other speakers here with me today are Brad Campbell from our Washington, D.C. office. As you probably know, Brad is the former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration, and that means that he held the position under the George W. Bush administration that Phyllis Borsey holds today. In other words, the top pension regulator and the top pension investigator. Also with me is Jim Dolan from NatTixis, and I'll get back to Jim in a minute, but I want to say that, as the operator said, this is being recorded. And once it's posted on our website in a few days, everybody invited to this conference call will get an email with a link to it. So if you want to share it with the other people in your firm, or if you want to listen to it again, it'll be there for you. Just in case you don't get that, in about 3 or 4 days, business days, it'll be posted at www.drinkerbiddle.com under a tab called Resources. So with that in mind, let me turn it over to Jim Dolan. Jim is the Vice President for Retirement Strategies at NatTixis. And as a part of introducing Jim, I want to thank him, and I want to thank NatTixis for making these presentations possible. Without their support, we just wouldn't be able to do it. Jim?
Thanks, Fred. And thank you, everyone, for calling in today. We appreciate you taking the time out of your day to join us. And I want to thank Brad Campbell for joining the call today, too, to share his insights. I wanted to take a moment to tell you a little bit about NatTixis Global Asset Management. We're a multi-affiliate organization that offers a single point of access to more than 20 specialized investment management firms throughout America, Europe, and Asia. We rank among the world's largest asset managers. We focus on durable portfolio construction. It's our philosophy that our company is dedicated to provide innovative ideas on asset allocation, risk management, to allow institutions and advisors address a range of modern market challenges. So that's a little bit about NatTixis. Wanted to let you know that this is our last call for the year. We've done about four of these this year, and I just want to take a moment and thank Liz Jutila, who is behind the scenes, who always helps, sets up these calls, and makes them a success. So thanks again for joining us today. And with that, Fred, I'll turn it back to you.
Well, thanks, Jim, and thanks for your support. You know, it seems to me that an appropriate way to start the phone call today is to talk about where we are. I mean, what's going on with the litigation against the rule? What's going on with the legislation in Congress? How will the presidential election likely impact the rule? And what's up with these rumors we're hearing about the Department of Labor possibly delaying the applicability of the regulation and the exemptions? To walk you through that, let me throw it back in Brad's court. And Brad, take it over.
Well, thanks, Fred, and thanks, Jim, and of course, thanks, Liz. That's a very appropriate thing to make sure we remember, because without Liz, I probably wouldn't be here on time ever, so I appreciate that. But again, most importantly, thanks to all of you who call in every quarter or so when we do this. We're very appreciative of the large audience that we keep getting, and we thank you for that. So what is the big picture? Is this rule happening? Is it likely to be delayed? Is it likely to be struck down by the courts? The short answer is we're waiting to see, but some of those are more likely and others are less likely. So let's start out with Congress. You know, Congress has taken a stand against the fiduciary rule. The House and Senate have both passed resolutions. The President vetoed resolutions against the bill. There's still activity potentially taking place in connection with appropriations. In other words, denying funding or attempting to deny funding to the government to actually implement the rule. All of that is continuing, but the reality really is, so long as President Obama is in office, he's going to be vetoing things that have anti-fiduciary rule provisions. So absent a situation where there's a giant must-pass bill that the fiduciary rule, you know, funding freeze sneaks into or something of that nature, it's probably not very likely that Congress is going to be able to do anything to materially affect the bill or the regulation, at least until probably there's a next Congress. So there's always that small chance, because you never know exactly what the end of the year shenanigans as far as passing giant omnibus appropriations bills might mean. But in general, Congress is probably not a likely avenue for this to be materially changed in the short term. The lawsuits are more of a wild card. There are three federal courts hearing something on the order of six or seven lawsuits from various entities saying that, you know, alleging that the Labor Department didn't properly follow the rules for promulgating a rule, violations of the Administrative Procedure Act, that the regulation exceeds the Department of Labor's authority to regulate, that it contains provisions that the department simply doesn't have the authority to do. By the way, color me sympathetic for a number of those arguments, but we'll see whether the courts agree. As I said, there's three federal courts, one in Kansas, one in Texas, and one in Washington, D.C., that's hearing these cases. Two of those three courts have had the sort of opening arguments in relation to the court's decision as to whether to stay the rule while it lets the cases go forward or not. The third one, the opening arguments are scheduled for November, I believe. So we could actually have a ruling from either of those two courts really almost any day. I don't want to say that in a sense saying I expect it to happen today or tomorrow, but simply the reality is, the particularly in the first case in Washington, D.C., where the oral argument was in late August, they've had several, you know, 5 or 6 weeks now to be considering those issues, and typically motions of the kind that were requested here, you know, on essentially an emergency basis, stop this rule from going forward because it's causing harm to all of us trying to comply with it, which is essentially what the plaintiffs there are alleging. The courts tend to rule on those relatively quickly. So we could be in a situation where we hear rulings from the courts in the very near future. Whether they win or lose, that's what we're waiting to see. So that is a possibility that the courts could change our schedule here.
Let me interrupt for a second and just ask a question. There's a rumor, at least, that the court in Washington, D.C. appeared to be leaning towards not issuing a restraining order or an injunction, but that the court in Kansas was leaning that way. What happens if they go different directions?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. My understanding, and this is where I'll throw in a minor caveat, which is I'm an ERISA lawyer, not a true litigator. So litigators listening may disagree. But my understanding is that if one court decides to let the rule go forward, saying that the plaintiffs there just hadn't met the burden that they need to stop things, but the other court disagrees and says, yes, we should stop this, that any of these federal courts has the authority to stop the rule on a nationwide basis. So my understanding is, to put it kind of in more of a colloquial way, the plaintiffs here only have to get lucky once, but DOL and the Department of Justice have to win three times.
And then it'll go up to appeals, right, from there?
One would assume that the government would appeal a decision. Let's say the court in Kansas did, in fact, stay the rule nationally while it hears the underlying case, that it's quite likely that the Department of Justice and on behalf of the Labor Department would appeal to the circuit court, and then we'd see what happened there. But, you know, obviously a victory in any of those three courts would be a tremendously significant development in this regulation. The only other caution I would say is, you know, people are always trying to read the tea leaves from oral arguments in these kinds of, you know, court hearings. It's really hard to know whether the questions the judge asks when he really grills one side versus the other, whether that means he actually favors them or not. So, you know, I think what I've heard from a lot of people who are true litigators is that it's often hard to know whether, you know, if the judge appeared to grill one side more than the other, that doesn't necessarily mean he would rule that way. It may just be that he's stress testing arguments for the other side. So, you know, it's at the end of the day, I think we're back with, we don't really know what the courts are going to do, but they do actually have the power to materially change this unlike, you know, Congress, for example.
And those first two cases focused primarily on fixed indexed annuities, didn't they?
Well, that's a big feature in all of the cases. It was more of a focal point for those two. But they're all making a broad suite of arguments against the rule. Part of, with the fixed index annuity portion, the BIC exemption, a lot of that's focusing on, is the Labor Department creating a new right, a new cause of action, and is that something an agency has the power to do, absent a direct congressional, you know, direction to do so? You know, did the department properly take comments and properly promulgate a rule that resulted in the BIC exemption being limited, that fixed index annuities could only go through the BIC exemption instead of 8424, and was that, you know, was that done in a way that actually gave the regulated community a meaningful opportunity to comment under the Administrative Procedure Act or not? So it's kind of interesting. The issues the courts are looking at aren't really ERISA issues per se. It's more ERISA as the example of how the Administrative Procedure Act is supposed to be applied. So these cases are really about administrative law more so than the underlying ERISA issues. And as I'll tell anyone who ever asks, and if anyone who's taken an administrative law course, if you think the 5500 is boring, try the Administrative Procedure Act. But so moving on, look, there's been this rule circulating that, or rumor rather, circulating that the Labor Department is about to, or is seriously thinking about, delaying the effective date, which is currently April 10th of next year. I keep hearing these rumors from various people saying, hey, do you think this is going to happen? And I think partly what it is the industry is making those requests. The industry is going to the Labor Department saying, look, we've been working in good faith for 7 months now, spending, you know, untold millions and hundreds of millions of dollars on doing this. But, you know, this is a tough road to do in 12 months, and we may or may, you know, we're not certain everybody's going to make it. You really should be giving us more time. By the way, Labor Department, you told us you'd be giving us guidance to help interpret some of these rules. You, the Labor Department, acknowledge you would need to do that even before the final rule came out, and yet we've had nothing but, you know, one round of technical corrections that truly were technical, you know, fixing typos and so forth. So I think the rumors are probably fueled more by the industry requests than they are by DOL receptivity to those requests. DOL has said nothing officially, or nothing I've heard unofficially, about whether it would at this point decide to extend the deadline. And frankly, I can't imagine that they have an incentive to make that decision yet. I personally think DOL wouldn't make that decision until, you know, essentially next year, would be my prediction. We'll see what happens. Obviously, it depends on who wins the election, and maybe that's a segue into that last point. Who wins the election probably is going to have an effect on how this rule is promulgated, how it's actually, well, more accurately, how it's implemented. We assume a Trump administration would be opposed, at least in part, to the rule and probably be receptive to slowing down implementation, although I'm not sure we actually have official statements to that effect. Conversely, we assume the Clinton administration, because she has specifically endorsed the rule, would continue forward. What's, I think, less clear about the Clinton administration is, would they be somewhat friendly to modifying questions, to guidance, softening some of the problems, or would they continue in a similar fashion, or perhaps even a more aggressive fashion? That's a little bit up in the air. Traditionally, I think folks have looked at the, you know, the previous Clinton administration and viewed them as being more receptive to the financial services community. But this election, obviously, Hillary Clinton has been getting a lot of advice and competition from folks like Senator Sanders and Senator Warren. So it's not necessarily clear what a Clinton administration, what their position would be as compared to the Obama administration. Clearly, they're for the rule, but how would that manifest itself in actually dealing with some of the implementation questions? So I think that pretty much hits the summary of where we are. Short of the courts acting, I think we have to assume that April 10th is the deadline and keep working towards that, even if something else changes down the road.
Yeah, and Brad, you know, that's my, what I'm seeing from my clients as well. They're looking at an April 10 deadline and saying, oh my goodness, we're not going to make it, or we're barely going to make it. if we hold off and wait to see what happens, and that it goes, you know, against the financial services sector. In other words, the courts rule or the courts don't issue the injunctions, then they're dead. They, you know, they just can't possibly get into compliance in time. So it seems like you know, the ultimate outcome when people analyze all of this is full speed ahead towards compliance. And if something comes along that's helpful, that's great.
Yeah, I agree. We really don't have a choice on compliance. The deadline is so short and the hill to climb is so high, people have to just keep, as you say, going full speed ahead.
Okay, well, let's flip over to something that is one of the major issues that we're getting questions about from clients. And this is across the board. This is the wirehouses, the broker-dealers, the insurance companies, the RIA firms. This seems to be the one question that cuts across every type of advisor or agent, and that is rollovers. The amount of money that's rolling out of plan and that will be rolling out of plans over the next few years because of the aging of the boomers and the retirement of the older boomers is in the trillions of dollars. I mean, we're at unimaginable levels of money, and the need of participants for help on how to manage that, either inside the plan or outside the plan. And one of the significant changes of this rule is that while the DOL in 2005 issued guidance that said if you're already a fiduciary to a plan and you make recommendations about rollovers, then that's fiduciary advice. And then in 2013, FINRA came out with saying that a recommendation to take a distribution out of a plan is in effect an investment recommendation. And I think the rationale was that inherently it involves a recommendation for the participant to sell the investments in the plan, which would clearly be a recommendation about securities. But this rule goes beyond all of that, and it says a recommendation to take a distribution is a fiduciary act under the new rule, beginning April 10 for everybody, regardless of whether you're already a fiduciary or not, regardless of whether you're regulated by FINRA or not. It's just anybody that makes that recommendation, then makes some money off the result of the recommendation, will be a fiduciary, because part of the definition of fiduciary requires a fee. It has to be advice or a recommendation for a fee. So we get to rollovers, and it's interesting, and the work we're doing on recommendations to take rollovers or on deciding whether or not to make it's possible to make a prudent or best interest recommendation to a participant to liquidate their investments in the plan and roll over into an IRA, we're seeing that the issues fall into two categories. The first is that certain information has to be gathered. And there are two reasons for that under the rules. The first is the rules require that the advisor act in the best interest of the investor, or in other words, satisfy something that's very close to ERISA's prudent man rule. And as you all know, particularly those of you who work with retirement plans, the prudent man rule requires that you engage in a prudent process. A prudent process requires that you gather the relevant information and then evaluate it. So the first step is to engage in a prudent process. Then the rules say, under the best interest contract exemption, says, and you need to document why the recommendation is in the best interest of the participant, including specifically, but not limited to, consideration of the investments in the plan and the IRA, the services in the plan and the proposed IRA, and the expenses in the plan and the proposed IRA. You have to have the information about the plan, but where do you get it? So the first step is gathering the relevant information. And what most people are doing or need to do is they're gathering information about, they're getting a copy of the plan's investment comparative chart. Some of you may think of that as participant disclosures, investment disclosures. Others of you may think of it as the 404A5 disclosures, but it's actually called the investment comparative chart. Getting a copy of the investment comparative chart, getting a copy of the quarterly statement, at least one quarterly statement from the participants, so you can see how their money's allocated in the plan. You can see what their account balance is, so you know how much money you're talking about. And with those two things combined, you should have adequate information about the investments and the expenses. You may not have enough about the services, so you may need to, one way or another, there's a probably need to gather some additional information. What are some of those services? Well, do they offer non-discretionary investment advice? Does the plan offer discretionary investment management? What are the fees for that? Does the plan offer a brokerage account such that they have a very wide range of investments in the plan? Because remember, you have to compare both places. Anyway, so whether it's through a questionnaire or some other means, there needs to be information about plan services.
You know, Fred, if I could just jump in there, I would say we also need to emphasize distribution options, because I think that's going to be a big difference between a lot of IRAs and 401ks for the, to serve the participants' needs.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's interesting. I'm hearing from different people that they do or don't want to consider that. But I view the flexibility of distributions from IRAs relative to the relative inflexibility of distribution alternatives from plans as being a significant factor. And for example, some plans, as Brad's comment suggested, may only allow lump sum distributions and minimum required distributions. Well, that's not particularly helpful if you're 60, if you're retiring at age 65 and you need the money to live on before you're 70 and a half. So I agree that the flexibility of distributions from IRAs. Another one that's, I think, is pretty significant is the guaranteed income. The need for promised income guaranteed by an insurance company, a good quality insurance company. And that a plan, many plans don't offer. Some plans do, but many plans don't. And, you know, you have to find out whether or not the plan offers a guarantee, and then you have to compare it to what kind of a guarantee you would be recommending. Well, if a plan doesn't offer a guarantee, I think that can be a pretty big deal. And I'm sure as people get more deeply into this, they'll discover more ways in which a plan might be more advantageous, or an IRA might be more advantageous. In any event, once you gather the information, then the next, that's bucket number one, getting the right information so that nobody can say that you didn't consider the relevant factors. Bucket number two, if you will, is once you got that information, what do you do with it? And that I refer to that as a comparative evaluation. Obviously a fiduciary evaluation, but I add the word comparative because you got to look at the IRA versus the plan. You have to compare. And at the very least, you have to look at the investments, you have to look at the expenses, and you have to look at the services. The concern that many people have is, wow, the expenses in the plan are often, perhaps typically, going to be lower, and in some cases much, much lower than in an IRA. For example, in the very large $5 and $10 billion plans, you may find that the investments expense ratios are 10 basis points, 2 basis points, 20 basis points, somewhere in that range, because they're separately managed accounts or possibly collective trusts. They're not mutual funds. So how do you offset? That's whether the differential in the total cost in the IRA versus the plan is 25 basis points or 150 basis points. How do you offset that difference? Well, step number one is it's a heck of a lot easier to have considerations that offset 25 basis points than it is 150. I mean, just think about it. It's just an easier proposition because if you say I provide the following services and they're valuable services, then they ought to offset a 25 basis point differential. On the other hand, with 150 basis points, the comparative analysis is tougher. And the key, in my opinion, are the services that the advisor and the broker-dealer or the RIA firm will be offering. I think it would be a good idea to have a service model, maybe even broken down by size of IRA, and taking factors into account such as I'll help you with your distributions and your investing such that the money lasts or should last for your lifetime, even if you live 30, 40 years in retirement. I'll help you with tax planning so that we're investing the higher tax assets inside the IRA and the lower tax assets in your personal accounts. I mean, on and on and on. Just a service model where you're providing a lot of value and where the treatment of the IRA is a part of that value. That becomes part of your comparative evaluation. How do you balance any differential in cost to the investor in a way that that the value of the services offset the differential? Think about, let's say it is 150 basis point differential. Let's say it's $1 million account. I can't do the math in my head, but I think that's $15,000 a year. If it is, then what services are you providing that are that aren't already in the expenses of the plan? I mean, what services are you providing that are going to justify $15,000 a year? Better asset allocation. You're there to help people when the market goes down and they have questions and they don't know what to do. What are your services? So I think your service model becomes very, very important under the rollover issue. Brad, you want to add something to that? I covered the points that I wanted to make.
Yeah, no, I think you described it very well, especially divided into two buckets. One's kind of, and I've heard you use this phrase before, Fred, which I like. There's an implied duty to investigate to get the information you need to make the decision or to make the recommendation. And if you don't have that basic information, you're not going to be able to make a prudent recommendation, which is going to be required either by the ERISA standard or the best interest standard, because both of them are more or less the same fiduciary process for making a recommendation. So you've got to get that information. And again, while some of the services information might be hard to get from some of those source documents, I think it behooves you to do so because, you know, going back again to distribution, if this participant personally needs monthly income, needs to be taking distributions monthly, and plans don't do that, that is a major factor that has real value. Now, it's hard to assess exactly what that value might be, but if it's going to cost them, say, $70 every month in an extra fee to get a monthly distribution, well, there you have a dollar value you can tote up rather quickly. So these are all factors to look at. The thing I would say that's probably harder in the evaluation phase, and this is more of a challenge, I think, for the financial institutions who are going to be overseeing their individual advisors who are doing the actual comparison, how do you supervise that? How do you structure that process so that if the factors aren't weighed in the right way, that it raises a red flag or that it, you know, causes you as a financial institution to have a supervisory question? And I think that's one of the challenges that's presenting a lot of difficulty. And as Fred said, for everybody, whether it's a broker-dealer, an RIA, an insurance company, whomever, that's one that presents a lot of questions. How do we structure the evaluation process in such a way that the institutions can supervise those activities?
And then let me add a couple more comments, and then we'll flip over to the next section with Brad. You know, picking up on what Brad said, there's got to be, you know, you can go so far with the objective criteria, expenses, investments, and so on, and you do hit a point like distributions, where and the flexibility of IRAs, where preferences come into account. Like, you know, you can't very well say this is worth 3 points or 5 points, but the participant says, I need the money. I need monthly distributions, and I need them now. You know, that's sort of you call it a preference, call it a need, but it goes beyond the evaluation of this other objective criteria, for example, beyond plan expenses. And so there needs to be some element in here for preferences. I think, you know, you can evaluate all the information, the objective stuff first, and then you can say, well, let's talk about your personal situation. Here's a list of 10 or 15 questions that relate to many people, and some of them may indicate needs or preferences that you have. And then you can have a preferences section of the process, or a needs, preferences and needs session that can result in the ultimate outcome. And then finally, it can even be, you know, based on the advisor says to the participant, based on the low expenses in the plan, which are appreciably lower than what we can do for you, I recommend that you leave the money in the plan. That's the advisor's duty. It's the recommendation. It's the fiduciary act. The participant then says, you know, that's all fine and dandy. I don't like the plan. I don't want to be there. I never even, you know, the last 10 years I've hated working there. I want my money out, and I want it out now, and I want to roll it over with you. Ultimately, it is the participant's decision. The recommendation is the fiduciary advisor's job, but the participant's money, and the participant gets to ultimately decide. That, though, presents a significant supervision issue along the lines of what Brad was pointing out. What if a broker-dealer gets a advisor who says 10 times in a row, I recommend that people leave their money in, and they all overrode my recommendation, they want to come with me after all because I'm wonderful. There needs to be a process for identifying why they want to come with the advisor, and I would recommend a process where at least some of those people, the broker-dealer calls up and says, we just wanted to double-check with you, and they actually have some sort of auditing process as a part of their supervision, particularly where a recommendation by an advisor is overridden by the investor. My final comment is that they're under what's called Bice Lite, or the level fee fiduciary alternative, which would apply if the account that the participant is rolling into, the IRA, is advised on a level fee basis. You have to document why it's in the best interest. It doesn't have to be real formal, but it has to be in writing. It can be electronic. It doesn't have to be on paper. But there has to be an indication that the advisors evaluated all this, evaluated the at the least the expenses, the investments, and the services in both places, the IRA and the plan, and then written down, you know, documented why it's in the best interest. I think there are going to be tools to help you do that. I know people are working on developing the tools to help with each of the, let's call them three buckets now, with the three buckets being information, evaluation, and documentation. So there are services being developed that will help people out. The very large broker-dealers are perhaps developing their own proprietary services. But other than that, there will be services that will be available for that. And I encourage you to take advantage of them. If there's one area that I think you need to be the most highly attentive to under the new rules, this is it. This is a biggie because it's a whole bunch of money moving all at once, and it's going to be highly regulated in the future. FINRA, the SEC, and the DOL. This is, you might view this as an IRA issue. The DOL doesn't. It views it as a fiduciary plan issue because it's money coming out of a plan. So the DOL can actually investigate this, unlike investment advice to IRAs, where you'd have to have a contract to sue on. So be careful. Be particularly careful here. Brad,
One last thought on that one is you're absolutely right that the documentation is certainly required as a condition of the exemption for the level fee option or the BIC Lite option, whatever you want to call it. But you know, as you just said, I think the reality is you're going to have the documentation for every one of these recommendations, no matter which exemption you're using, because they're all going to be potentially subject to question and a key focus for all the regulators. And if you're using the BIC exemption in the IRA space, a key focus of potential litigation risk under the new state law breach of contract. So all of this is going to require a lot of documentation. And bottom line is, if you didn't write it down, it didn't happen, and you're the one I'm going to mix a lot of metaphors. If you didn't write it down, it didn't happen, and you're the one with no chair when the music stops. How about that?
Yeah, there you go. And just to pick up on that, that I don't think most people realize, as we do, Brad, that when you're claiming an exemption, whether it's the full BIC or Bice Lite, the burden of proof is on the person claiming the exemption. In other words, the burden of proof is on the advisor and the financial institution. It's not on the participant. All the participant has to say is, you recommended a roll. and then the burden of proof to show that it was prudent, that all the requirements were satisfied, or at least that a prudent process was engaged in, is on the advisor and the financial institution. So this is a pretty harsh new reality. Back to you, Brad.
Well, so the next issue we're going to take a quick look at are the issues facing fixed index annuities under the new regulation. So as we alluded to earlier when we were discussing the litigation, the Department of Labor in the final regulation as kind of a surprise move took fixed index annuities and also variable annuities and put them under the BIC exemption, taking them away from the traditional insurance exemption 8424 where they had previously resided. And the result of that is that you more or less have to have a BIC exemption in order to advise on a fixed index annuity because typically you're going to be selling those in a commission-based environment, and where there's a commission, there needs to be an exemption. So in essence, in most cases, if not almost all cases, you're going to have to use the BIC exemption to advise on fixed index annuities. The problem is the BIC exemption is only available for financial institutions, which the Labor Department defined as a bank, RIA, broker-dealer, or insurance company, which did not leave room for a lot of insurance intermediaries, let's call them, field marketing organizations, independent marketing organizations, others in the insurance space who have traditionally played a role in the sales of fixed index annuities. DOL did invite those entities to come and apply for individual exemptions, and many of them had. And in the interest of full disclosure, we should acknowledge that we represent, we Drinker Biddle, and I myself and Fred as well, represent a number of entities who have applied for that financial institution status through the exemption process. That process is ongoing. There are a lot of discussions going on with the Labor Department. The sense we get, although of course nothing is final until it's final, but the sense we get is that the Labor Department is interested in moving forward with an exemption to allow those insurance intermediaries under conditions, new conditions, additional conditions to the BIC exemption to serve in that capacity. So all of that's continuing. We'll see when and how the exemption process comes out, what the conditions are. Those are all obviously important issues to the applicants and to this space. But the other aspect of that is it's resulting in the reality that for these types of intermediaries, they're having to deal with becoming BIC financial institutions, but are well behind the timing everyone else who intends to use the BIC exemption has. For example, broker-dealers who intend to use the BIC exemption have been working on it and planning on it since the regulation came out in April. The new financial institutions, assuming DOL does an exemption to allow insurance intermediaries to fill this role, will be starting that process well near the deadline. And that's going to raise a lot of concerns for them in figuring out how to set up their BIC processes, how to set up the policies and procedures, identifying the material conflicts and so forth. And so we thought we'd focus on a couple of issues that are common to everyone who's looking at a BIC, but which are going to be particularly an issue for some of these folks, which is, the BIC exemption essentially requires the agent, the producer, the advisor, whatever phrase you want to use, who's talking directly to the IRA owner or the plan participant, it essentially requires them to be level compensated, with the exception that if the financial institution chooses, it can create different levels of compensation, but only for products that it's able to clearly indicate are different product, readily identifiable sort of classes of investments, which, based on a neutral factor, justify a different level of compensation. And so an example that we've talked about in the past and that they had in the regulation was the neutral factor of time. If it takes longer to explain this class of investments than it does some other class of investments, that could be a basis for identifying how much longer and coming up with a higher level of compensation based on that additional time. Another way to think of that is, at the end of the day, though you might make more selling this product, your return on time investment is the same because it took you longer to advise on it. And so that is a challenging situation for how granular you want to get on the investments that you are viewing as identifiable classes. So say within fixed index annuities, is there a difference between, say, a 5-year and a 10-year schedule on how you look at those? One thing, go back a second and be clear, what is not a valid reason for having differential compensation is that Company A pays a different commission than Company B. You could potentially justify a different commission for all fixed index annuities or all fixed index annuities that have these particular set of features, but not Company A's annuity versus Company B's annuity because we got a different financial arrangement with the carrier who's providing that annuity. So it raises a lot of these challenges that these entities are going to have to work through, as are all other BIC entities, BIC financial institutions. But unfortunately, even if the Labor Department gets their status resolved and grants it to them, they're going to have the least amount of time to come up with the right answers to that and work through each of their solutions as we go through. And that's, again, as Fred also alluded to earlier, that's part of the reason why in the litigation, this is one of the areas that there's been a lot of attention paid to whether the Labor Department really properly promulgated this portion of the rule in particular. Fred, what do you want to add in there?
Well, one of the points I was going to cover a little later, maybe I should talk about right now, which is what you just said, that any BIC organization has some of these issues. And I think if take the same scenario that Brad was talking about, but think about a broker-dealer. The broker, and I'm going to use some labels, but then I'll come back and explain them. But the broker-dealer's compensation for its selling products under BIC has to be reasonable, but can be variable. So the two magic words are reasonable and variable. The words to remember for the compensation of the individual advisor for that same sale are reasonable, level, and neutral. And what I mean by the broker-dealer can have variable compensation, but it has to be reasonable. In Brad's example, he was talking about different product providers might pay a different first-year commission or a different trail, and the broker-dealer gets all that. They get the full payment. As long as the services that the broker-dealer and the advisor are offering are reasonably justify that, then the broker-dealer can keep the variable but reasonable compensation. But when the broker-dealer goes to share those revenues resulting from the sale of the advisor, the advisor's compensation has to be level across all products. In other words, no matter whether they sell the ABC, in this case it might be a variable annuity rather than a fixed index annuity, but the ABC variable annuity or the XYZ variable annuity, no matter how much each of those pays the broker-dealer, the advisor has to be financially agnostic among products. So if a reasonable compensation is 1% in the first year, and 50 basis points a year thereafter for the advisor's services, no matter what product, which variable annuity is sold, no matter how much the broker-dealer got as a payment from the insurance company, the advisor is going to get 1% the first year, 50 basis points every year thereafter across all the variable annuities that broker-dealer has a selling agreement with. And it has to be reasonable. So that's reasonable on level. But what if the broker-dealer is also selling mutual funds under BIC? So one investment category that, as Brad was saying, there, you have to break things down into investment categories, which are a combination of products and services. To the extent that the product and the service together would justify different compensation, reasonably justify different compensation to the advisor, then arguably that's a separate investment category. So let's say, for example, that the second category is non-discretionary investment advice on mutual funds. Well, now both categories have to be reasonable. Within each category, the compensation of the advisor has to be level. But any differences between the two categories have to be based on neutral factors. What is a neutral factor? Well, Brad said time. Another one is complexity. I think another one is value, if you can quantify value, the value being added by the advisor. So a neutral factor is anything that doesn't tie to the amount paid for the sale. In other words, a commission is not a neutral factor. I mean, so neutral factors just mean they have to be independent, relevant factors that reflect the services and value being received by the investor. So for the individual advisor, in my hypothetical, the compensation has to be reasonable. It has to be level within each investment category, and any differences between or among investment categories have to be based on neutral factors. That is a huge change, and it's a very difficult change for people to grasp because it's so different than how it's being done now. It's so different than the advisor receiving, say, 80% of the commission or 80% of the 12b1 fee. So what the broker-dealer gets in 12b1 fees is absolutely irrelevant in terms of what gets paid to the advisor under this scenario. So, Brad, unless you have objections, I'll move on to the next thing on my part of the agenda, the fourth and last part, and we'll leave a little bit of time at the end for questions. What about plans? What about when advisors become fiduciaries to plans? Well, what we're seeing is most financial institutions, such as broker-dealers, that have advisors that are not sophisticated on, let's say, 401k plans, they're looking for the record keeper to have a platform fiduciary, for example, a 321 fiduciary. And I would say of the different ways people are looking at that, the one that makes the most sense is where the platform fiduciary might pick, say, 100 mutual funds that the platform fiduciary certifies as reasonable, prudent, and then the advisor selects from the individual advisor who is inexperienced with 401k plans selects from among those. In that way, the broker-dealer or the financial institution and the advisor are protected because they're only dealing with a group of prudently selected and monitored funds. So the retirement plan area seems to be working itself out pretty easily under this new rule. I don't mean that to be a universal truth, but by and large, when you look at where we're spending our time advising clients, very little time is going into retirement plans, and clients seem to be developing solutions fairly quickly. But when you look at rollovers, IRA transfers, and advice to IRAs is changing, it's a lot of our time is going into that. Mentioning IRAs, you know, what's the impact of the fiduciary rule? Forget the exemptions. What's the impact of the fiduciary rule, the best interest standard of care going to be on IRAs? And I think one of the major impacts will be that the concept of prudent investment advice from retirement plans is going to gravitate over to IRAs, which means that advisors will need to apply generally accepted investment theories, like modern portfolio theory, and prevailing investment industry practices, like selecting the appropriate share class, focusing on the expense ratio, and looking at the stability and quality of the fund management, and so on. So I think this concept of prudent investing is going to cause IRAs, even small IRAs, to be invested in portfolio-type investments and not exclusively in single-asset funds. So maybe a balanced fund or a target-date fund for a smaller account, an asset allocation model or a managed account for a larger account. So in a way, I'm trying to drive that point home to some of my clients by saying, take IRAs out of your wealth management group and put them in your retirement group. Now, you don't literally need to do that, obviously, but it gets the concept across. What about the sale of life insurance policies and fixed-rate annuities, traditional annuities? Well, those are under 8424. So you hear us refer to prohibited transaction exemption 84-24. It is a separate exemption from BICE, and it is much, much easier to comply with. You still have to adhere to the best interest standard of care. You have to prudently select the insurance company. Your compensation has to be reasonable, on and on and on, but it doesn't have all of the other conditions and limitations that BICE includes. So our experience is that most people looking at this issue are going to sell life insurance policies and fixed rate annuities under 8424, even though BICE says if you want, you can sell them under BICE. But we have a couple of clients who want to sell them under BICE. Why? With BICE having a class action provision, you know, you have to allow class actions. Why would they possibly want to do that? Well, 8424 says that the advisor or agent can only receive a commission, period. No trips, no awards, no bonuses, no nothing. Only a commission. And where BICE, if properly managed, allows additional compensation. So there needs to be the analysis going on there from one institution to another, financial institution to another, is if do they want the difficulty of complying with BICE and the class action possibility versus the simplicity and ease, relatively speaking, of complying with 8424, or do they weigh the ability to have these additional programs for their advisors based on 8424 compensation as being a more important factor? By and large, they're deciding 8424, but not everybody. Also, one last thing, and then I'll open it up to questions. There's a concept of level fee fiduciary, and it's being bantied around, and it has two meanings, and it means different things in different places, so I just want to clarify that. Ordinarily, most of us think of a level fee fiduciary as someone who charges a level fee, like 100 basis points, to manage your account. And then they say in their agreement, but if we get any other money, any 12b1 fees or any payments, we'll offset it against that so that we don't make more than our 1%. That is perfectly permissible. There is two advisory opinions from the Department of Labor, the Frost Bank advisory opinion, the Country Trust advisory opinion. They're actually referenced in a footnote to the preamble of BICE as a workable way of doing things. And that's great. That works fine. But under so-called BICE Lite or level fee fiduciary for capturing rollovers, the so-called streamlined provisions of BICE Lite will only apply to level fee fiduciaries, but the Department of Labor, or at least spokespersons for the Department of Labor, have said if you get any other money, even if you offset it, you are not a level fee fiduciary for this purpose. And I don't think that's the way the rule should be read. I mean, as worded, I don't think it should be read that way. But they're the DOL and I'm not, so that makes it dangerous. So if you want to use the streamlined BICE and you want to take a conservative position, the streamlined BICE Lite, and you want to, for capturing rollovers, and you want to take a conservative position, make sure that you're a pure level fee. Otherwise, there is this argument based on comments by DOL speakers that you should be under full BICE for capturing rollovers, meaning the website, the transaction notices, on and on. I just want to alert you to that because sometimes you hear terms thrown around that people are using for one meaning or the other, but depending on the context can mean different things. This is one of those. So, Deanna, I think we've got about 10 minutes for some questions. Will you open it up?
Thank you, sir. If you'd like to ask a question, please press *1 on your touch-tone phone. Please be sure you're unmuted so your signal reaches our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Again, *1 for questions. We'll take our first question. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, this is Patrick Davitt from Autonomous. My question's around the wirehouse and his broader brokerage community implementation schedule. Where do you think we are? Because I still feel like we haven't seen that many announcements about what exactly they're doing, really just Merrill Lynch's a couple of announcements around not having commission-based accounts in retirement and cutting their mutual fund list in half. So I'm just curious kind of where you think most of the brokerage community is and more specifically what you are seeing them plan to do in terms of the kind of funds they offer and the amount of funds they offer.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at the media reports, there's three firms that have come out and made statements about what they're going to do. Merrill Lynch, which only, that's being overread, as I think, as applying to everything. It only applies to their brokerage accounts, I think, their announcement. Number two is Edward Jones, and number three is LPL. So those, they're obviously all very large organizations. The big guys, you know, speaking, let's say, the wirehouses, are way ahead of most people, in my experience. And they need to be, because they're so large, they have to develop so many, you know, for them to develop things and make cultural changes and train people is a much bigger proposition. When you get down below the really big broker-dealers, they break into two categories. You know, the broker, let's say those with 800 to several thousand advisors. If they have proprietary products, you know, affiliated mutual funds, for example, they're going to have to go under BIC because their corporate leadership is going to want them to be able to continue to sell proprietary products. Well, that's a conflict of interest, obviously, and because they make more money. And so they're going to be under BIC. They're going to have to be under BIC for the kinds of accounts that sell their proprietary products. For those at that same size level that don't have affiliated proprietary products, I think many of them will opt more for the level fee scenario, sort of like Merrill Lynch did. But you can understand that more easily, let's say, for advice on portfolios of mutual funds. You know, get rid of the, if you go level fee, get rid of the revenue sharing, get rid of the 12b1 fees, get rid of the front-end loads. Mutual funds would need to give them a stripped-down share class, something that pays no money and looks a lot like an iShare. I don't know all the share classes, but I've heard people refer to it as R6. And so I can see them going very much as possible to the level fee scenario. Partially because it's just easier. It's also less, it will be less regulated because you won't have BIC and less expensive. When you get down below that, I'm not really representing many broker-dealers much below that size. I worry particularly when you get down to 50, 100, 200 advisors. I worry about the expense of this and the difficulty of complying. I think you're going to get a very mixed bag. I think you'll get some under BIC, some under level fee, and that there won't be a pattern at all that you can really identify, except perhaps level fee to the extent possible. I'm seeing some small firms where the broker-dealer has an affiliated RIA. In other words, they've operated very much like a level fee RIA in some cases, very much like a broker-dealer in other cases. They're really shifting over to the RIA model. They're going to minimize, they're going to grandfather, for example, their broker-dealer accounts to the extent they can, and then or make them not unsolicited. And then they're going to say anybody who wants ongoing advice needs to move over to our RIA. So I think the outcome of all of that will be higher fees, particularly for, well, not for everybody, but higher fees for smaller accounts, but more service for smaller accounts. So I don't think the fees are just going to be, I'm going to charge you more and you're going to have more costs. I think there'll be more services that go with that. But that's what we're seeing now. I mean, many people are still in the process of making decisions. So that's the best thing.
Are you seeing, you know, underperforming funds getting dumped? Is that really happening yet? Or pressure to have more passive in funds, particularly on the retirement side?
Not yet, no. I think right now, people are really focused on the impact of the prohibitive transaction rules more than the fiduciary part of it. So right now they're very much into a compliance mode rather than a process mode. I think what many broker-dealers are going to do will be they'll turn to their advisor. Well, you know, think about what I said for 401k platforms. You know the main 321s, Mesirow, Morningstar, Wilshire Associates, those guys. Whatever their programs produce is going to be the funds that get used. So I would want to know what their programs, how they select funds for plans. Now you get down to IRAs, and I think they'll be similar. programs? I mean, I know there's some of them out there like FI360, RPAG, and others, where if I think the advisor is creating portfolios for IRAs, will be more inclined to use those programs. And what the results that they produce will end up with the ones being selected. At this point in time, I've yet to see broker-dealers say we're going to terminate selling agreements with some mutual fund families. But, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, maybe.
Great, thanks.
Sure.
We'll take our next question. Please go ahead.
Fred, this is Susan Jennings, and I haven't heard very much discussion about when a advisor approaches a client who has an existing amount of money in an ERISA plan or an IRA and advises the client to roll it over into a non-affected DOL plan like a governmental 403B or 457. I'm concerned about that because if we develop products for our DOL-influenced plans, are we also going to be required to put those into situations where they're going into a plan not affected by this new rule?
Yeah, you know, there's an anomaly there where if you make a recommendation to a participant in an ERISA-governed plan or in an IRA, that's covered by these rules, even if you recommend that they roll to a non-ERISA plan. But if you're making a recommendation to a non-ERISA plan that they take the money out and roll over, that's not affected by these rules. It's a very, very strange. And but yes, there's an issue there if it's a recommendation to an IRA or a recommendation to an ERISA-covered qualified plan. Operator, we can take one more question.
Thank you. We'll take our last question. Please go ahead.
Yes. Question. We're a registered investment advisor, and we take IRA rollovers from retirement plans on a regular basis. But typically what happens is that the decision is already made by the client or the prospect that they want to move the assets out of the retirement plan. Does that still constitute the requirement to fulfill the fiduciary rule, have a best interest contract, or is that something that just needs to be documented that the decision had already been made by the prospect or the client?
Yeah, there's three ways you can get IRA rollovers, if you think about it, you know, from a legal perspective. One way is a recommendation, and that's a fiduciary act. The second way is you can educate the participant. For example, you can say, what I think doesn't matter. What matters is what's right for you. This may be the single most largest amount of money you move on one day in your entire lifetime. Let's talk about it. Then you give them a brochure that talks about their distribution options and the considerations, and we've drafted that for some companies. But you give them a brochure. I like that because it's written evidence. Then you have sort of a script where you say to them, let me explain some of the points in here that many people find important. And you sort of walk them through it. But you can't cover everything, obviously, so you pick the highlights. And then if they say, yeah, based on that education, I want to roll over, you get an acknowledgement in your account opening form or your advisory agreement or somewhere that says, I acknowledge that I made the decision that no recommendation was made, that I was provided with the XYZ brochure on considerations. And then the third way, And education is okay as long as it's unbiased, by the way. I mean, it needs to be relatively complete and unbiased, and it's not a fiduciary act. The third way is what I call unsolicited, which is what you just described, where someone comes to you and says, you know, you've managed my money for years. You've done a great job. I've really enjoyed working with you. I'm retiring. I want to move my money over to you. Well, you haven't made a recommendation, and you haven't provided education. They just made the decision. And that would be unsolicited. For risk management purposes, I'd like to see you have something in your account opening agreement or your advisor agreement that says, that describes what happens, that we didn't provide a recommendation, that you independently made the decision before contacting us to roll over your money to an IRA. So, and that should not be considered a fiduciary recommendation. Okay.
That sounds
good. Yeah. Okay, everybody. I'm sorry to have to cut off. I know there are a few questions waiting, but we promise to leave a little more time next time. Our next conference call will be after the first of the year, January 26th. We'll know what the election results are. The new president will have been sworn in. We'll be in a slightly changed environment, and we can bring you up to date then. I do want to thank Matt Pixis again. I don't know if you all realize how important they are in terms of sponsoring us, but they've been great. Anyway, operator, that's it for today. Thank you very much.